This is Edge Cases, a podcast about the grumpier side of software development, mostly, but not always, Apple-related, featuring myself and my co-host, the Ren and Stimpy of Objective-C. I'm Andrew Pontius.
And I'm Will French.
This is episode 41. It's Saturday, March 16th, 2013, and our topic this week, presumably it's part three of our 10-part series on getting things done.
Oh, it's very close. Actually, it has nothing to do with that. It is branch theory and practice.
Ah, okay. Yes, very much. Yeah, of course, one right after the other. Of course, that's what I would have suspected. Cool. Okay, so again, I don't believe we have any follow-up, not even any general glow like we did last week. So take it away.
Okay, so I'll just kind of start going down the list of, it's one of these, one of these topics that I thought, it would be okay to have a 15 or 20 minute episode after our long span of, 40 minute plus episodes. And now I have a text document that's taller than can fit on my 27 inch display. So this is obviously not going to be one of those quickies anymore, but
it's fast.
Yeah, I may have to do that. Okay, so like I said, the title is Branch Theory and Practice. So I'd like to talk about kind of the different branching models and kind of the history of them and what I think about them. So start off with for me, this version control basically goes back to CVS, and I'm not going to talk about it basically at all except that it's supported branches, and CVS is horrible, and you shouldn't use it. So that's easy enough.
Done.
Yes. So look at how much progress we're making on this list already. Next, and basically the next two ones are also horrible. Horrible subversion. And subversion is actually subversion for straight line code, I find is fine. It's not glowing awesome, but it was so much better than CVS. I hightailed it off CVS as fast as I could. And that said, that subversion, it was not a branching master. Well, with subversion, it was actually pretty easy to create branches. Where you got screwed later was the merge.
Oh, yes.
So do you remember the svn merge.py script?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, so it turns out that in versions of subversion before version 1.5, I mean, how many times can I put version in that sentence? But before 1.5, apparently there was not enough information actually stored by subversion to effectively do merges. And there was this extra Python script called svnmerge.py that came with subversion. And I don't know what magic it did, but it would maybe try to do some more stuff or something, have some sort of heuristic. I linked to it. I didn't, all these will have links. I didn't bother actually going through and reading what it did because I want to not remember that part of my life. And
did you ever use it? In anger or otherwise?
I probably did, but yeah. But with subversion, I wasn't very branchy, and that's because branches were kind of heavyweight and kind of awkward to merge. So this, I would go out of my way to write straight line code, even if it meant basically copying a directory, kind of doing it in there locally, and then kind of manually bring it in locally. So it was like poor man's Git, essentially.
Sure. My experience, unfortunately, with subversion was that I did have I was working using it with a larger team, and we had to do multiple merges at the same time, multiple landing of branches, and it just very, very hard to do, very unintuitive when things went wrong, and I would never do it again.
Yeah, pretty much. And so, since bad things come in threes, we can wind up the horribleness with perforce. And the perforce is not strictly a horrible thing, but long ago I wrote a blog posting called "Why Not Perforce?" and to my knowledge, nothing's changed. I mean, perforce has a very specific model and can make sense for certain types of use cases. In particular, I think it probably makes sense for game development, where you have large kind of binary assets, and
interesting. Mm-hmm.
You're working on a LAN, and that if you have large binary assets, perforce then makes sense. But for everything else, for the common case of open source software or smaller code bases that we write, I would not recommend it.
I've often been complimented on my large binary assets.
I can't believe you went there. Okay. And so the couple of highlights on my Why Not Pro Force post was really boiled down to two things. Was that Perforce had a lock, modify, unlock usage model, where you had to lock the file when you go to modify it, and then you have to unlock it. And in comparison with CVS, Subversion, Git, Mercurial, basically all the other players, where you make the changes you want to make and let the version control system then figure out what's changed and how it's changed, that's so much easier than having to ask Mother, may I, before every single thing you want to do. And of course, then it's also more non-blocking because it's file-level locking. So if I'm modifying a method and you're modifying a method, I've locked that file so that you can't go and modify your method. You have to wait on me. The other problem with Perforce was its utter reliance on the network, which is great when you're on a LAN. It's terrible when you're like me and you're using you're having to use a VPN, and which I was having to use Cisco KEX, where the kernel extensions were just terrible and all very crashy, and it was all together just terrible. But I said it was not black and white because why I don't recommend Perforce unless you're probably like a game developer company or you have other large binary assets. A good thing has came out of Perforce, and that's Laura Wingard, I guess how you say her name. And she is, I don't know, she's a higher up in Perforce, and I don't know what her title is now. But she wrote this book called Practical Perforce, which this is a book I bought when I was trying to come to terms with Perforce, thinking, you know, this is just me not understanding things. If I actually read a book about something, I'll understand why it is the way it is, and then I'll use it effectively. And it turns out that's not the case. You just shouldn't use Perforce. But that said, in Chapter 7 of this book, she does a good job of the chapter is titled How Software Evolves, and kind of gives usage stories about, like, basically the philosophy of branches and how they work. And this is really the golden part of the book. I can't recommend you use Perforce, and so it's kind of hard for me to go and tell you don't use the software, but go buy this book for this one chapter. But fortunately, you're in luck because she ended up doing a Google Tech Talk on pretty much the same topic, and that is a video of the presentation that she did at Google, and I'll include a link to that. But I'll to save you from having to go through a 1x video streamed via YouTube, I will kind of summarize her points here. But if you are interested in anything I say here, it is, and I'm going to skip over some of it. If you want the in-depth thing and you want to go at 1x, then it's worth your time to actually watch this video. It has a lot of good stuff in there. So first thing that she has the kind of the idea of kind of giving roles to branches. And so you'll have, you know, we're all familiar with like the mainline branch, which is, if you can call it a branch at all, it's like it's kind of the default branch. Then she talks about project branches, and project branches will have feature branches. And then you'll have release branches and patch branches that kind of branch off the releases. And one of the things that she talks about is that it kind of goes to the philosophy of the Perforce way of doing things, is that they have she talks about integrating branches. Although if you listen to her Google Tech Talk, she coined the term code line or streams, because branch tends to be kind of overused. And then she instead of in her book, instead of merging branches, she talks about integrating branches. Although in her Google Tech Talk, she thus seems to use pretty much branches exclusively and talks about merging them almost exclusively. So it is kind of a more common lingo there. So I think she just kind of devolved into it while she was talking about it. But she seemed to be very more strict in her book when she had more control over the words on paper than the words coming out of her mouth, which is why we do the podcast, so we can get ourselves in trouble, right?
Absolutely.
And so the difference between integrating and merging that she points out is that merging, this sounds kind of dumb, and it mostly is. Well, where integrating is there's more decisions involved. Like there might be parts of the merge you left behind, or you might not merge it at all. So you can actually integrate a branch without ever merging them fully. In terms of the idea of how like Git would think you've merged a branch, you could integrate them completely without doing a Git merge. And so Perforce apparently has some better ways of like basically marking whether a branch has been integrated or not. And that's, I think, lacking in Git and all the rest. But it seems mostly academic, or at least I wouldn't say it's academic, actually. I would say this in the real world, and when you tend to like delete feature branches after you're done with them, it's not too much a real practical issue. But I could totally see why you'd want to have, to capture every little bit in the system if you're building a system. And obviously, Perforce built their own system there. So one of the great things...
I would say that one of the big problems I have with Git and with Subversion was that they really couldn't store all the metadata that I would have wanted them to about merging and integrating.
Mm-hmm. So one of the really great things I think she does is that she's coined this thing that she calls the tofu scale. And she basically... I told you all the types of branches you have. Where the main line, you have project branches and release branches and the like. And she came up with this idea of basically ordering them in terms of how firm they are. That is,
wow.
About, yes, their relative firmness. And when you think of firmness, you can think about like, what's the risk in changing it? Like, how well is it tested? How much change does this branch represent? What's the risk of making a change to this branch? So that's what you think of in terms of firmness. And at the very top towards the top are the release branches, where it's like you're basically taking the main line, you made a branch, and you're basically just trying to stabilize it. And so that very few changes are going there. You're actually trying to minimize the amount of changes you make into there so that you can stabilize for release. And so that is... it's firm on top, and that's the firmest the tofu gets is on top. So that's, and it just gets squishier and squishier the further down you go. And so at the very bottom would be basically the feature branches, where you're making write new features that the world should not see at all yet, and like even QA shouldn't see them yet because you're not even done writing them yet, or this is a terrible data loss bug in there that you can't even send over yet. So she has this, the tofu scale. She then ends up using in various places in her talk, which helps kind of talk about once you measure like the firmness of branches, you can. I think it adds a nice dimension to how to reason about how changes should migrate between branches.
It's certainly a very vivid image of thinking of your branches. Although I mean, would runny be like the one end, and
I don't know what type of tofu she's eating, but my tofu has a pretty squishy. General consistency. I mean, I like the eggy tofu, but that's squishy, pretty much kind of more liquidy all over, but yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm? Okay. So another thing I really like about how she goes about talking about this stuff, not just the tofu scale, but she also kind of starts off in terms of emulating the ideal world. And so she has this fantastic list of things. Like in the ideal world, there are no bugs. In the ideal world, we have all the time in the world. Schedules never slip. The first release is always perfect, and customers always upgrade.
Ooh, I want to live in this world.
And I think she does a great philosophical take on this, because she then, in taking these five bullet points of the ideal world, the reason for existence of all these branches and the techniques are all couched in terms of how can we take the real world we live in and make it emulate the ideal world. And so if, it's like, for example, there are no bugs. So that's why we'd have a patch branch that we'd have all the time in the world. That's why we have project branches and feature branches and staging branches. Schedules never slip. So that's why we have, you can have a project branch that is off in its own world and might take a long time. Even if it runs over, you still can maybe ship a part of it while it's ongoing. In the in the first release is always perfect. Well, you know, obviously that it'd be great if you just could ship 1.0 and it's be all end all done, right? But that's not how it works.
What, we ship version 2. You don't do that?
We ship version 2, we ship version 3, and we just kind of keep on iterating towards platonic perfection of software. That's going to be, I'm sure it's going to be a throwaway, rejected title right there. But
it's like the Borg scale, sort of.
Okay. That's, yeah. So are you saying that you fall on the Trek side of the world then? You just give yourself away?
That would be a whole podcast.
Okay. And then, of course, the customers always upgrade. That's, you know, so we can, the idea that you can go back and do a feature, you can do a bug fix on version 1, even after you're shipped version 4. Like, not that we do that very often, but, you know, but you can see how in the ideal world, all these things are true. It's obviously not, we don't live in the ideal world, but you can adopt a model that can basically make the real world kind of emulate the ideal world. And so she talks about the mainline model, and that's has to do again with the tofu scale, where it's you have the mainline, and off the mainline you have a release branch, and off the mainline you also have project branches, and off project branches you have feature branches, and then you'll have off the release branch you'll have maybe a QA branch and a beta branch, and then finally perhaps a live branch for things actually when the bits hit the platter. And then she talks about her baseline protocol, which is what's the protocol for dealing with changes across these different branches? And this is where the tofu scale kind of interacts with the mainline model in terms of how the changes flow. That changes flow from the firmer branches to the softer branches continuously. So if you make a change in your release branch, that should basically, as soon as possible, be propagated down to a project branch or maybe even all your feature branches. But changes should flow from the softer branches up to the firmer branches only when they're finished. And she even has this concept that you should merge down, but you should copy up. And so that's, there's all sorts of nice little heuristics in her talk, and it's I guess hers was the first thing I read that really gave me a conceptual model why all these things would be the way they are and what's the reasoning behind them. So it's just awesome. She talks about things in her talk like modules and how they affect branches and how you should use them that I won't even start getting into here because I'm already probably going to be pressed for time. I guess it depends on how fast I talk, but it's... I do have some disagreements with how she structures things, but it's definitely, if you like to think about these things and kind of understand the philosophical underpinnings of why everything is the way it is and what's the reason for it, then I highly recommend it. Okay, and so once we get past the horrible CVS and horrible subversion, we get kind of the land of cheap branches, and I actually forget how cheap the branches are in Perforce, but I'll just say that it's probably good, like Git. And once you have cheap branches in the land of Git and Mercurial, that it really allows you to it's definitely a better model. And you know, obviously, what Subversion obviously had cheap branches is the fact that somehow these other systems are able actually to merge them. So you almost could think of cheap branches meaning effective merging is a different way of thinking about it. But anyway, so branch often, vote early, vote often. So branch early. Branch often type thing.
Well, merge often.
Right. Yeah. That's a good point. Branches are useless if you don't eventually wind up with a merge. So yeah, yep. Merge early, merge often. Yep. And that kind of leads me to my next talking point, which is Git flow. And have you heard and/or used Git flow, Andrew?
I have heard of Git flow. It is on my to-do list to find out what the hell it is.
Oh, good. Well, I would recommend listening to this episode.
You know, I'll get right on that.
Is that the fourth wall that we just heard crashing down?
Wait. We got to stop this so I can go listen to it.
So Vincent Driessen, I think is how you say his name, wrote this article called A Successful Git Branching Model. and which he documented how he uses branches and his reasoning behind all the branches. So very much like Laura did, Vincent kind of provided a system and the reasoning behind this system. So I'm a big fan of, you know, kind of walking through the philosophy of things and, you know, kind of first principles kind of guy. So so he gives names and roles to the branches, like Laura did, and he codifies how to use them. So basically he defines a protocol. And more than that, he wrote a tool, again, well, I guess not again, but called Gitflow, which automates the use of his model. When he wrote a successful Git branching model, he basically said, this is the model, these are the branches you have, and this is how you move the changes back and forth, and this is what they're for, and this is how you move the changes back and forth, and these are the Git commands you need to use. And remember to specify dash dash no dash ff, or no fast forward, because you want to have that commit object, and blah, blah, blah. And so I end up writing a fairly large script that automates use of this. Automates use of this model, and so that is called Gitflow, Git-flow, and you can easy install with homebrew. So I think it's like brew install Git-flow, and
I think what's the one that I use? It's SourceTree.
Okay.
Has a Gitflow like mode or something.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, yeah. Hopefully I'll come back to this when I get to the criticisms of Gitflow, because okay. I actually used one of the criticisms against it. But so remind me if I don't think of it.
Okay.
So the model behind Gitflow is pretty straightforward. You have two main branches, the master branch and the develop branch. And the idea is that the master is always production ready. So you can hit the button to ship on master at any time. As a matter of fact, he says that... he tends to be pretty strict at this. So in theory, you could use a Git hook script to automatically build and roll out your software to production servers every time you commit on master. So that's to the extent that he wants master to be production ready. The other branch, the main branch, is the develop branch, which you can put potentially breaking changes where you can integrate them and test them. So Gitflow also is big on feature branches. So how this will work is that you go to add a spell checker to your word processor. And remember when you actually had to do that? You actually had to write your own spell checker? Well, anyway.
No.
Memories.
Did you write your own spell checker?
No. I couldn't find like any reasonable... I mean, there like in the back of pages of MacTech magazine, like there would be companies selling spell checking plugin that were way beyond my budget or whatever. So I never could get close to that. So great that that's built in now. But anyway, so you have this feature, and that's where you should be doing your feature development in the feature branch. But then you should integrate into master, and that's where you do your, integrate into develop. And that's where you do your testing. And if you integrate it into develop and it breaks, you haven't shipped broken software. It's all self-contained in the develop branch. You can then fix it up there. So you have the concept of feature branches, and so like I said, that Gitflow gives you a nice high level interface. So in how to actually start a feature in Gitflow is you type in git-flow feature start, and the name of the feature in this case would be a spell checker, and then it'd say, okay, I've started a new branch, I've based off develop, I've named it feature/spell checker, and you're sitting on that branch now. When you're done, execute the following command, which will be git-flow feature finish, and then the name of the feature, which again in this case would be spell check, and then it will wind up other things. So the act of creating a feature branch and finishing a feature branch and creating release and finishing release, these are all high level commands that you can issue to Gitflow. So you don't have to kind of have this model in your head and make sure you're doing all the changes correctly. That you're following the protocol to the letter, because obviously it's a protocol, so this is something that software can handle for you. And probably the only other thing that there's a couple things that might not be obvious. There's two other types of branches, the release branches, and the release branch is fairly short-lived, probably lasts only, I would say, 10 minutes. It's based off develop, and all you pretty much do is you bump the version numbers, you ensure your readmes are and your documentation is up to date, and then you say Gitflow feature finish, 1.2, and it will end up merging that into the master branch, and now you're it's actually ready to go out over the wire to your customers. And the other branch that's in his model is the hotfix branch. That's when you have a release out there and you've gone ahead and you've been working on the next version, but you found a showstopper bug in a release version. So you need to go back in time and fix that. And he calls it hotfix branch. Laura calls it the patch branch. I think, let's see. Yes, patch branch. So, but it's the same concept. You have the release branch, and then you base a branch off the release.
Yeah, it's interesting that they don't just consider those to be another variant of a regular release.
Yeah, you know, it is kind of odd, and I think that's actually probably a good segue to the criticism of Gitflow. So, Scott Schocken, who works at GitHub. I think he's their CIO now. I'm not sure, but he's written a bunch of. I think he wrote ProGit is one of his books, and he's definitely he teaches Git, he writes about Git, and works at GitHub. So obviously, Git is in corpuscles in his bloodstream or something like that. And he wrote a blog posting called GitHub Flow, and I'll actually quote him here because he did a good job explaining himself. He says, "One of the bigger issues for me is that it's more complicated than I think most developers and development teams actually acquire." So you saw how I walked through the different, you know, the master branch, the develop branch, feature branches, release branches, hotfix branches. And he says that's actually more complication than what most developers and development teams acquire. And So he goes on to say, "So why don't we use Gitflow at GitHub? Well, the main issue is that we deploy all the time. The Gitflow process is designed largely around the release. We don't really have releases because we deploy to production every day, often several times a day." And I think that's a very good clarifying point in terms of whether you should use Gitflow or you should use GitHub Flow, which is if you're an iOS developer. And it used to be, you know, with Sparkle, it'd be totally feasible for an app developer to push, you know, release out a day. Now that we're tied to the App Store, we're with the, you know, 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 week waiting period between when we submit an app and when it actually could go out, we're actually kind of going retrograding. I don't know if that's correct, but we're going back to this, you know, kind of to the time where you had to like press CDs or. I was almost going to say burn floppies, and that's mixing
right. It's so funny, right? Because something which should be very instantaneous, you know, getting your bits out,
right,
is actually extremely cumbersome.
Yeah,
and my company has definitely had to, you know, drastically alter how it handles releases because you can't. There is no such thing as a hotfix, really.
Right. If it still is, it would be a hotfix. That would be if you ship 1.5 of your app and you start working on 2.0 and you found there's a crasher in 1.5. So it would be a hotfix. It would be a 1.5.1 or whatever.
a lukewarm fix.
Right.
You know, and
right.
you get one shot at the one that goes really fast.
Right.
And if you use that up, then it's however long before you get another one. Yeah. So, you know, what I'm saying is you can't base a reliable workflow on that. Because you only get a certain number of those per decade,
right? Yeah. So so the GitHub Flow is definitely, you know, it's one thing when you're deploying a Rails app, but as iOS developers, increasingly Mac developers, the world we're in is actually this world of where releases are actually big events, and so in that way. I think Gitflow is probably a better model to follow because it's you know it provides that importance on releases. Whereas if you are doing one thing about GitHub Flow is that it assumes continuous integration. It assumes that it's cheap and easy for you to push out new releases, and that works really well for them. And so if you are in that position, then it's quite possible that Gitflow is a too heavyweight for you. So let me talk a little bit about GitHub Flow here and their model. And it is it is a lot simpler. So the idea is the first idea is actually just the same as Git flow, which is anything in the master branch is deployable. And then to work on something new, you create a descriptively named branch off master. So in this case, this is where Ori deviates from Git flow, where you have a separate develop branch, and you'd base your feature branch off that. You're in GitHub flow, you're basing it directly off master. You commit to that branch locally and regularly push your work to the same named branch on the server. So that way, everyone can see the work on your feature, but it's not actually integrated into the master yet. And if you need some feedback or help, or you think the branch is ready for merging into master, how GitHub works, which kind of makes a lot of sense, is you open a pull request. Well, of course, GitHub would use pull requests, and pull requests is definitely, back in my day, you know, when GitHub was in its early days, man, they didn't even have pull requests yet. They had cherry picking. That's all you got.
That was like back in what, the 50s, the 60s?
Yeah. But all you had was if you were cherry picking, and we liked it. But they've definitely beefed up their pull requests to the point where it's really a great kind of a system for code review and for asking questions and getting feedback before you actually go ahead and merge your branches. So, I could totally see why. You know, it seems like pull requests and how they work in GitHub was kind of eating their own dog food type stuff, where they use GitHub to build GitHub. And they added the features they need, and they did not add the features that... It's one of these things where it's like, if you were sat down in your academic ivory tower and you decided how you're going to structure a code review system, it seems like it'd be really different than what pull requests are today. And because you'd probably think in terms of like objects and how they interact and processes and all that. And with pull requests, it's much more, we already have this version control system, Git, and this is how it works. And what's the kind of the minimal stuff we can bolt on to that and that makes our lives easier? And so they just kind of have like this kind of a timeline model where you have the pull requests, and then you can do comments on it, and then you can make more commits to that same pull request, and until finally it sells down and the pull request is merged. So it's very lightweight, and but it's really powerful. So that's, in fact, they seem to put excessive amounts of time and crafting new ways of putting emoji into their commenting system. So I think, I don't know what that means really, but
well, I mean,
it seems to be a high priority for them.
It's basically just a branch, right?
Emoji?
Like the pull request system from GitHub.
It's indicating that one branch should be merged into the next. But of course, that doesn't necessarily need to be ever executed, the merge.
Sure.
I don't know if you would call it a branch itself. But it's a way of, it's basically the metadata of being able to talk about a branch. And okay, it's a future merge into, in this case, master.
Okay. I mean, I haven't used them very much, but
okay. That's... Yeah. And... And the final point in the model is that once the pull request is merged and pushed to master, you can and should deploy immediately. And again, this assumes continuous integration. I wouldn't be surprised if GitHub doesn't have it set up so that when you merge into master, that I believe it. I believe Scott actually mentioned this in his blog post. Basically, every push they do to all their branches that are on the server, they run continuous integration tests on them. They run the tests on them. And I assume that once, I don't know if they have to do, I know they're big on their chatbots, but it may be that once you push into, once you merge into master, that it does, that's the new version of the site and it gets rolled out. But I wouldn't be surprised if you don't have to issue some sort of, you know, chatbot thing. You know, once the chatbot comes back and says, hey, continuous integration, all signs green, go ahead, and then you might have to issue another command to actually make it live. But
well, I would think, I mean, if you're going to make something like master, like some element of your Git repository be the live version, then what you'd have to do is make another version of the repository, another branch, where you can actually live on, and you can actually have be what is the normal state of your development. Because you just can't have it be such that pushing it back to where you normally push things back to when you're done with your work is deployment, because that's just unrealistic. There are always extra steps to take before you deploy.
Oh, I think their model does that, because I assume that they basically have a model where you can run your own little GitHub locally.
Well, like if it's master, then master can't be where you naturally just land things.
Right, that's why they're big on feature branches. Basically, you never commit to master directly. It only goes, you always start off on a feature branch.
But I mean, you'd need, But in my mind, though, like you would then need your feature branch and somewhere you can land the feature branch, which is now testing mode.
Right. And, well, that's the thing, is that just by pushing your feature branch so that other people can see it, the continuous integration Jenkins robot also sees that change and automatically builds it and runs it.
Yeah, but you got to have people.
Sure.
You got to have a place for people to be involved.
Yeah. But that's where the pull request comes in.
We're not at Skynet just yet.
Well, that's where the pull request comes in, that once you think things look good, you issue a pull request to master. I don't know who the people are involved who decide on whether it's good enough, but that's where their code review happens. And that's when they decide, this looks like we just can push it live. Okay. And that's when the merge happens. Okay. And this doesn't have to do directly with branches, but I want to point out that there's this tool called Legit, which is, I'll explain it in terms of, there's this app called GitHub for Mac, or GitHub Mac, I think. And it's Andrew, you were looking around. I know you end up settling on SourceTree, but did you check out GitHub Mac for managing your repos?
I did.
Okay. And I guess it sounded like it didn't make the cut.
It so didn't make the cut. And I think I tweeted about it. They did this weird thing where they took a change that I made on disk and committed it automatically. I guess something weird like that. And maybe they've stopped doing that, but I was like, that's it. Nope. Not going to let a tool do that to me. Mm. You know, you'll commit when I tell you to commit. And that's the only time. If you try to read my mind and you fail, then you're, get rid of him.
Man, it sounded very authoritarian there. Right. But you failed. You try to read my mind and you fail. You're dead. yes, but I tried GitHub Mac as well. And I don't like the Tweety style interface that has cropped up like a virus in Mac apps. So that was the first big strike against it. And it didn't really seem to do anything for me versus what I was already doing on the command line with GitX. So I didn't end up using it. But then I learned about this tool called Legit. And apparently it's basically a lot of the niceties that GitHub Mac has, Legit offers at a command line interface. And I haven't used it myself, but I wanted to mention it since we're on the topic. And it's not really related, but since we're already talking about GitFlow tools and stuff like that, might as well. And probably the nicest thing is that the type of like obvious things that you think that you kind of need to do, Legit will do for you. So like when you're switching between branches, if you have a change in branch A and you want to switch to branch B, it will automatically stash your changes so you can successfully actually switch branches. And then I believe when you switch back to branch A, it will automatically unstash those.
Okay, that's nice.
Yeah, that's pretty nice. And there's a few other things. I haven't installed it or used it myself, but it seems to be there's a bunch of niceties that are in GitHub Mac, which as an application, I'm not using myself, but apparently they have a bunch of niceties that are kind of wound up in this command line tool called Legit, and so it's worth checking out. And of course, that will be linked to in the show notes.
Well, it sounds legit.
Oh, man. Just had to go there.
Sorry.
And finally, actually, I'm doing very well. What is that? That's a three. Okay. I'm actually doing pretty well on time. This is not an hour episode, and this is my final topic.
Okay.
And then I know you're glued to my blog, Andrew, but have you seen my latest post?
Did you post today?
Yes, I did. I posted half an hour ago.
I haven't seen it yet. I'm actually still using Reader.
But the entire episode should have been about RSS, right?
Is it?
Because all we can talk about is South by Southwest and RSS.
Yes. And what else? I'm sure I can think of other things. Anyway, go on.
Yes. So One thing I want to mention, since we're on the topic of branching, I want to talk about a pretty specialized branch naming system that I guess I invented, that I wrote up in a blog posting that, again, will be linked to in the show notes. But it's basically, it's semantic version branches for submodules. So if you're like me, you have separate repositories for lack of a better term, submodules. And I hate to use the word submodules because they have a specific meaning in Subversion. They have a specific meaning in Git. And that's not what I'm trying to directly invoke, although there can be overlap there. I could call a subsystem. I could just call it module, maybe a library. But the idea that you have this kind of like this standalone chunk of code that doesn't do anything by itself, but to use in multiple projects. So a library probably is the best word for that. And I recommend a using semantic. I think we talked about semantic versioning before, didn't we, Andrew?
If we did, I don't remember.
Okay, so semantic versioning is if you go to semver.org, semver.org, is a write up by yet another GitHub guy, Mojumbo, whatever is Tom Preston Warner. Yes, that's his real name. I think that's the guy who wrote it off the top of my head. And essentially, it's a codification of what developers and use, and to a lesser extent, you know, gearhead users, but to the lesser extent, users kind of intuitively understand. But it's really powerful because it's a codification of this pretty simple system. And the idea is that you have has to do with version numbers and major, minor, and bug fix type stuff. And it's applied. And the entire idea behind Semver is that it's has to do with basically kind of conquering dependency hell. And it doesn't conquer it directly, but it kind of gives you a philosophical framework to how things should work and why things should be the way they are. And it's pretty straightforward. The idea is that when you start off on code base and it's unstable and you're changing the API, and the public API is in churn, you're really at semantic version 0.x, where x could be an arbitrary number. And so it'd probably start off at 0.1. And as you make changes, 0.2, 0.3. And once you have a public API that actually is consumable, that's stable for clients, then that's your 1.0. And then if you were to then make bug fix changes on that, that'd be in the bug fix. So 101 or something like that. And if you are adding to that API, that's when you use the minor version number, so 1.1. But if you're going to make a breaking change where you enhance the API to the point where it's incompatible with prior clients, that's when you bump the major. So that would be your 2.0. And so this seems pretty straightforward as I'm just talking about it with you, but the codification here is really important because it's I can look at a version, no, I'm using 1.42.3 of your library. And I see, oh, it's now at 1.68. And I just from looking at a number and knowing what number I'm using, I can say, oh, he's added some stuff to it. In fact, probably a lot of stuff with that many version number changes. But it is still compatible. I can just upgrade that library. And that's and I can go on my merry way. Whereas it's without the system, it's you know, if you make a breaking change, you're like, oh, sorry, you know, maybe there's a tag sitting in a Git repo somewhere for you to, you know, to hold on to for the rest of your life. But this is a way of kind of codifying these changes. So the idea is to apply semantic versioning numbers to branch names. So the idea is that the when you create a Git repo, you get the master branch by default. And I'm putting my foot down here and I say that's a bad idea for a repo that's going to be used as a library. In my blog posting, I refer to it as an attractive nuisance, that often I'll go up to library repos and I try to get a grasp of what's going on by looking at their branch list, and their branch list oftentimes will be unwieldy because they're like, they create a ton of feature branches and that's fine, but I just want to use the freaking library. And so the first thing I'll go for is the master branch, whether that's good or bad. I know what the master branch is. It's probably have one. And I actually recommend in this in the semantic versioning branches that your repo does not have a master branch. Instead, it just has semantic versioning named branches. That way, you kind of force the user, the consumer of your library, to make a decision and understand what version of the code he's getting. And fortunately, this is pretty straightforward for the consumer, because GitHub allows you to set a default branch for your repository, so that in this, in many ways, it will be transparent to user. You know, they just go to your GitHub's libraries page, and they'll just be by default sitting on the 2.0 version of your repository. And nice thing about this is that the 1.0 is still sitting right next to it. It's still backwards compatible with all your previous consumers, but all the new users will be using the new branches. And this is kind of hard to explain in voice over. In fact, all this branch model is kind of hard to explain this in talk. So I recommend looking at my blog posting that gives basically the naming conventions for this. And I also obviously, you know, an entire the Git flow branching model tends to be kind of involved and definitely helps with Vincent's illustrations. So I recommend checking that out. And of course, you know, Laura's talk has tons of diagrams as she walks through it. So even if you're maybe you're not too interested in how in her model, it's still worthwhile as a grounding in the topic and kind of introduce you to the concepts, because her walking you through in video form is a really good way to get bootstrapped on this stuff. And oh, wait a minute, wasn't there something that I was supposed to mention on GitHub Flow?
We were talking about source tree.
Yes, truly. Yes, that is another criticism that Scott brought up, is criticism of Git Flow, is that some developers use GUI tools, and I guess some developers, you'd be you and me, and it seems like because Git Flow is kind of an evolved model, and it needs this helper script, and it seems like the people who are least able to use Git Flow is all about helping the common case, and so it's kind of helping the noobs. And so, you think that the noobs would want to use a GUI tool that handles pretty much everything for them, and that's exactly where GitFlow doesn't work. But it sounds like SourceTree has actually added the GitFlow model, so that I guess that argument has now been obsoleted.
Well, I was just looking at it. It when you click, there's a GitFlow button, and it brings down a sheet which talks about initializing with an S instead of a Z here, so it's a British initializing, the repository for GitFlow, and it apparently creates a bunch of branches. I'm not sure what else it would do if it then...
It should also plop you on the develop branch.
Well, right, but then does it say you can only do the actions that the script would normally allow you to do, or does it just from then on let you do any of your normal actions, it just kind of tries to guide you into this?
Is there a button there or a menu command for basically create new feature branch?
Well, that's the thing. I'm not going to turn this on for any of my projects. Well, all right. We'll go a little crazy, or we're going to do this live.
Wow.
Initializing. So there's
people,
a develop
don't try this at home.
Branch. And it's just master develop. But I still have so now I want to branch off of master develop. It still just lets me do a regular branch.
Yes, that's the thing with Git Flow, is that it is a superset of Git. So everything you want to do in Git, you still can do. It says Git Flow adds policies and protocols on top of that, that encodes. And so I would suspect that you'd have some sort of ability to create a new feature branch, and that branch would be named feature/blah.
Okay. Well, you know, for example, it's letting me go back to master and just branch off of that.
Okay.
Normally,
I'd be surprised if it didn't let you. I can understand maybe a GUI that would stop that, because you're not following the Git Flow way. But
yeah. But I also there doesn't seem to be a new actions create develop branch or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's all just the normal actions that are everything that Git lets you do. So I don't think it does any more for you. You know, maybe we'll get some feedback on this, but I don't think it's letting you do anything more than what I don't think it's trying to help you any more than just setting up these extra branches.
Okay.
Is what I'm saying.
Okay. And that pretty much does it for me. Is there anything else you want to add?
No, that's pretty much it. I'd like to look at your blog post and look at some of these other things before I have too much else to say. I mean, I do like the idea of, like you have been saying, well, I guess I do have something to say. You have been saying a couple of times that, you know, Git was the building blocks for a source control system.
Right.
Instead of being a source control system, it sounds like in some ways GitFlow is trying to be that system that is built on top of the tools, because it narrows down what you can do and sort of attempts to get you to do more of what's right instead of just doing anything you want?
Yes and no. I mean, usually when people say that Git is a tool set for building a real virtual control system, that was before a lot of the porcelain was in place. But you know, nowadays, obviously people are using Git directly all day, every day. So that argument's kind of fallen by the wayside. But that said, Git is doesn't give you policies for this type of stuff. It just gives you the raw ingredients, raw abilities. Mm-hmm. And that's what you're right in that, yes, GitFlow is a good set of ideas and structure for actually getting work done.
Although, I think it's true of just about any version control system. Like Subversion didn't try to give you, these are the branches you should make either. And if the purpose of things like GitFlow is to make it easier, as you said, for the noobs to set up structures that they can that can channel their work in the best manner, so there's the least amount of duplicated work, there's the least amount of ill-advised branches. I mean, that feels a bit like training wheels that I don't need. Like, I don't necessarily need them to tell me what branches I need to make. I know what branches I need to make, and I know that the branches I'm going to make are going to be my best approximation of what branches I think I need to get the work done with the least amount of duplication and extra effort. If I'm doing more merges than necessary, well, that's bad. But if I'm doing a lot of extra work to make a single branch account for two streams of development, well, that's bad too. So I need to find that compromise there. And that's going to be different per project and per company, per team, in ways that I don't think one system to rule them all is really going to satisfy. So that's really, now that I've heard a little bit more about GitFlow, it actually interests me a little less as something that I might do. Now, in terms of finding out, you know, what other people do so that I can cherry pick good ideas from that, well, sure. But I doubt I would tie myself down to it anytime
soon. I would say that you're probably, when you say that, oh, it's a bunch of work that I don't need to do. Actually, I think when you go to make any sort of branch, the branch has a role. And regardless if you're going to do it manually or whether you let GitFlow help you. And GitFlow predefines those roles for you and gives you that philosophical structure for it. And it also automates a bunch of stuff for you. So I think actually you probably, for almost everything you need to do, assuming a limited release schedule that iOS apps have, that GitFlow probably would end up saving you time. And it also would give you this great piece of documentation that you can give to your team members and future team members, saying this is how we do things.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm certainly it's on the to-do list. I'm going to look into it a little further, but I am still skeptical. Shocker.
So I expect nothing less.
All right. Okay. So please visit our website, edgecasesshow.com, all one word, for show notes, a link to our podcast on iTunes and more. And you can find us on Twitter, me, A Pontius, that's APONTIOUS, also the same on app.net, and Wolf, his last name, Wrench, that's the word rent, RENT, plus Z, plus SCH, and we'll see you next time.